discussing the idea of people who believe that there are certain times that are fortuitous for certain things. This comes under a prohibition, a very serious prohibition of lo ta'onenu, that a person is not supposed to get engaged in things like astrology. Astrology is that form of avodah zarah, of idolatry, where a person seeks to find out whether this is a good time to do a thing or not to do a thing. There's a certain belief that when a person does something, the time that a person chooses to do something is significant and has a determining effect on the outcome. Now, that idea in and of itself, when people read the astrology charts and act upon that, in and of itself, that's idolatry. It's a very serious prohibition. The reason behind it is because a person who's rooted in the true idea recognizes that everything comes from God. Hu Elokeinu Einod. He is our God, there is nothing else. That's a very important point, the fact that there is nothing else. Many of these people who engage in these practices or other types of things that are similar may claim that they believe in God, but that doesn't limit them to negating the possibility of other things. We're obligated to negate other things, that whatever happens is either a result of the natural order, which is God. That's divine providence in setting up the system, the laws of nature, as we've discussed many times. And we're obligated to act in accordance with the laws of nature. And indeed, very often, that's the answer as to why a thing happened has to do with nature. It's something which comes about as a result of the natural forces, and not everything that happens necessarily means that God specifically intervened and wanted that particular to happen. Although that can be the case. That's the idea of providence. We don't know. Generally speaking, we don't know in a specific case. The problem is that many of these types of beliefs and practices, one of them which has to do with the times, or one of them which has to do with certain other accidents. It may not be something inherent in the time, but it could be something, the same result, that a person may walk out of his house and see a black cat going by, or any kind of nonsense like that, and say that's a bad omen. That's the idea of omens, to base oneself on certain omens, which may seem harmless to people, but that is the same idea. This is not a good time. Here, however, it's determined by a certain accident which occurred, and leading to an interpretation that this is not a good time, which means to say that the outcomes are determined by other factors. There's other forces out there that one way or another bring about the outcome. That is, a person whose approach to life is founded on the proper foundations would react. Someone says, we can't do this today because we had two black cats walking by in a certain way, or whatever other kind of nonsense, and therefore we can't do it. Why not? Because it's a bad sign. Would mean the intelligent person would react and say, what are you talking about? What does time have to do with it? The success of the venture or the failure is going to be determined by a number of factors, most significantly the plan that we utilize if we're acting with intelligence. Aside from that, in any plan, there's a lot of unknowns. See, due to the fact that there's unknowns, the more the unknowns, the more the emotion of insecurity, uncertainty comes out. And people can't tolerate that. The less the unknowns, the more a person feels that there's control over the situation, the less they get involved in these things. So even people that are superstitious by nature and engage in these things, there are certain things they're not going to apply it to. If it's a question of going to the supermarket and getting certain things and getting other things that you need, when it comes to relatively uncomplicated tasks where a person more or less feels safe and secure, then they don't have recourse to this. If a person is getting into the car and has to drive to the airport, most people, unless you have a severe case of superstition, feel a certain sense of security and confidence about what they have to do. So the phenomenon of it being a bad time, fortuitous, not fortuitous, most probably won't come into play. But where the venture is more complicated, well, it's not, for example, flying from one place to another. So that evokes certain fears. When the fears are evoked, then the person who has this false philosophy will be more prone to finding out whether this is a good time. Well, certainly when it's major things like business and you have no control. But the intelligent person realizes that that's something that you have to accept. But it's true that in terms of business, there are factors that are within your control, and then there are factors that are outside of your control. And that when you're dealing with the factors that are outside of your control, well, there's two possibilities. Either you'll act rationally or irrationally. An irrational approach would be to allow yourself to descend into the world of these primitive emotions to gain a certain type of security. That's irrational. Superstitions, different idolatrous practices, something which would appeal to your emotions in one way or another and try to redress the feeling of insecurity. But a rational person would reject it. A rational person would say, this is absurd. Because there's no system to this. It doesn't make any sense. So there's no relationship. There's no causal relationship between the one and the other. So just because a cat happened to walk by, and there are certain people that have established that as being some kind of an omen, a rational person despises that type of thing. The rational person will say either that's something I can't control, and I have to do the best I could do, and that's it. If my plan is in line with the realities, it'll be successful. If not, not. However, a rational person who has convictions in the Torah, who's familiar with the basic doctrines of the Torah, knows that there is something else that's involved in the outcome, and that's the phenomenon of providence. So there is something else that you could do. You could pray. You can perfect yourself. You could seek to act in a manner which would give you a greater possibility of being involved in the providence. But other than that, there's nothing inherent in the time itself. Now, when you have in Judaism, you will encounter notions which seem to indicate that there is a propitious time. The Rambam talks about that with regard to Aseret Yemei Tshuva, the 10 days of repentance. And there he makes it very clear that tshuva, repentance, and self-improvement is applicable at any time. That's the basic idea. A person shouldn't reserve tshuva for a certain time of the year. That's something that applies at any time, whenever a person sins, or even if he didn't sin. There may be other reasons why a person should engage in introspection. The reason over there is because there's an objective phenomenon of God judging the world. So when you have God's judgment, and so to speak, meeting out reward and punishment, things that will be impacting on a person's life from a supernatural source, but the real supernatural force, from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, from God, so then it makes sense that a person should repent at that particular time. Because God, when he runs the world, does reserve a certain time when the judgment will be set up. So, even though a perfected person doesn't wait for judgment, is always wants to improve themselves, but nevertheless, we're human beings. And in recognition of the fact that there will be a decree, we want a good decree, so that's the proper time. But there's a logical reason for that. It's not that there's something magical going to happen to you at that time. People seek to make up all kinds of nonsensical things because they're searching for a certain panacea. And therefore today, there's a new practice that's been instituted. It's not been decreed by the sages. It never existed in Jewish history. The idea that a kala under the chuppah is now burdened with an obligation to make herself as depressed as possible by praying for all kinds of things and all kinds of sick people. And we're living in an era when the emotions of the masses are having a big impact upon the practices of the Jews. What is the reason, what rational reason would there be for a kala who's under the chuppah, and this should be a happy time, a time of celebration, and to the best of my knowledge, we didn't have this in the past. Now it's become politically, religiously, politically correct to do. So everybody has to do this. And everybody piles all of their necessities, illnesses, this sick one, the other one. What's it based upon? Why is it important for a kala at this particular time to be saying Tehillim and praying for all these causes? It just seems to be totally contrary to the idea that she should be rejoicing. So they create the idea that this is a very propitious moment for her prayers. Now, what kind of thing is that? On the basis of what? Where does that come from? What's the motive behind this? So it seems that people are not content with following the system, the halachic system of engaging in perfection. The truth of the matter is that, you see, everything becomes magical. They're looking for panacea. Even the idea of everybody saying Tehillim, and you have the Tehillim groups, because the Jews have experienced certain types of sufferings. And the response is a religious response, but it's not a religious response which reflects the true idea. The true idea would be to genuinely introspect, to genuinely search for the truth of Judaism. That's something that nobody wants to be involved in. I was just saying this morning, I was talking to someone that had heard my tape on the issue of why so-called bad things happen to so-called good people, that whole issue. And I was remarking that the answers that Judaism gives are not satisfying to people's emotions. It may be a rational answer. I'm assuming it's a rational answer. But that is not what people are looking for. I mean, it strikes me that it wasn't my answer. I'm basing myself on an explanation of not just of the Rambam, the Chinuch, the Ramban, all of the great commentators, just elucidating, essentially, the idea. And in addition, I said that in general, Judaism doesn't really offer answers to one's questions as much as it seeks to show you why the question is not a valid question in the first place. That is to say, the removal, the negation of false ideas that people hold is a very significant thing in terms of reaching perfection as far as Judaism is concerned. But of course, the entire world is looking for answers. And by answers, they mean something that will be in conformity with their emotional expectations. But the truth is not. Judaism maintains that this is the truth. The compassion of the Torah is that it prevents man with the truth. And the truth, at first glance, is not something which the emotions are going to be pleased with. The demand is that the individual have the ability to conform, adjust his emotions to the truth, to accept that as reality, not the emotional picture, to accept the truth as the reality, and live in accordance with the truth, live in accordance with reality. That's the demand that Judaism makes of a person, and there's no compromise when it comes to that. And that's why Judaism is not a popular religion. Unless you see that all the different groups in Judaism are searching for answers. Whether it be on the left, whether it be on the right, whether it be Hasidic groups, everybody is trying to spin it in such a way that they can derive a certain type of emotional satisfaction from it. And that's the prohibition of the Torah, not to add, not to detract, not to change it, not to distort the Torah in any way. Because the motive behind all distortion is to gratify the emotions. That people are not interested in the truth. People are searching for a certain type of religious, emotional comfort. And in my opinion, it is not to be found in Judaism. You're not going to find it, unless you fool yourself. So therefore, you have a lot of the religious leaders and rabbis and so on developing a certain type of approach or theology and projecting ideas which one way or another are feel-good ideas, and then choosing the sources which seem to be in line with those feel-good ideas, and that becomes Judaism. So essentially, a person is confirmed. All the basic feel-good ideas that you always had are really true, and these are the sources. So then a person's happy. Of course, they've learned nothing. True Judaism means you've got to put aside, forget about all these emotional desires, forget about comfort, forget about that satisfaction, and engage in a search for the truth to the extent that you're capable of discovering it and to the extent that you're capable of implementing it. That's why Judaism is not popular, because it demands something of a person. It doesn't give anything to a person. All the other religions give you something. They give you a pill to swallow. And they give you an answer. This is it. And depending upon whether a person can put themselves into a kind of irrational framework where they can accept it, because the answer is not based on any kind of reality. So if they accept it, it gives them a illusion of comfort, an illusion of having an answer. But it's just an illusion. Now, Judaism is completely different. Judaism doesn't believe in illusions. That's the stark reality of Judaism. As far as getting back to the issue of propitious times, if you're going to say that a time is propitious, there is such a concept, of course. That's not neglected. Just bear in mind that if you say over what I said so people can come back at you, well, you see, for example, in Pirkei Avos, you find, for example, in Pirkei Avos, in the fourth chapter, 23, number 23, Rav Shim ben Elazar Omer, Rav Shim ben Elazar says, Al tarata es chavercha b'shas kaso. Do not pacify your friend at the time of his anger. V'altanachameyu b'shoa shemeso muto lefonav. And don't offer consolation at the time that his deceased is right in front of him. V'altishalo b'shas nidro. And you should not seek to induce him to free himself from the oath at the time when he makes the neder. V'altishtade leroso b'shas kalkaloso. And you should not strive to see him at the time of his downfall or corruption. You see from here that there is a phenomenon of timing. It's telling you this is not a good time to pacify your friend when he's angry. It's not a good time to console him when the deceased, so to speak, is lying in front of him. That doesn't mean physically lying in front of him. Essentially, from a halakhic standpoint, it's called meso mutlafanav, would be the time that the deceased is in front of him, would be the time between death, from the time of death till burial. And the person has a special status of being what's called an onin, which is different than being a mourner. Mourning doesn't begin until the burial is complete. So, I mean, superficially a person could say that here too, it's a matter of time. There's a good time and a bad time. Here, it's not a question of taking the time. The time is an accident. It's understanding psychology. And that is that while it's a good thing, all these things would seem to be a good thing. To pacify someone is a good thing. Sometimes, here too, one of the lessons of this statement is that even if you have good intentions and you want to do something good, very often you're disappointed. You set out to help somebody, and it turns out that the matters were worse. And you may even get angry at that person. I wanted to comfort you. That indicates that it's not enough just to have a good intention. It's not enough just to have a positive desire. Here too, if you don't use chachma, you can't just follow your emotions, your inclinations, even your good inclinations. If you don't use wisdom in seeking to achieve your objective, there's no guarantee that you'll achieve it, and you could achieve, in the course of doing or trying to do something noble, you can make matters worse. But a lot of people don't look at it that way. Then they get very upset. Why is it this way? I wanted to do good. I only had good intentions, and now I created a whole problem. Very often when that happens, a person's not going to look inward. A person may look inward if they had bad intentions. And then things became very bad. And because they had bad intentions, they feel guilty. So if they feel guilty, they may be prompted to investigate, acknowledge what they did. But when a person has good emotions, they don't feel guilty. They feel righteous. Here the Torah is saying it doesn't really matter what the emotion is, what the desire is. That's one thing. That's fine. But in order to succeed, it has to be done with wisdom. So thus, you have to anticipate the psychology of the other person. There's a time. That's a good practical lesson, by the way. This carries over in many areas. It's good to bear it in mind in terms of the family, in terms of children, in terms of your spouse. Very often it can masquerade a negative emotion, because sometimes, you know, you want to apologize, you want to make up, but your timing could be wrong. And then it doesn't work and you get angry. So you can sort of switch. You switch gears. Now you're angry at the other person. Timing is always an important thing. Before you do something, it's a perfection. Because generally speaking, when you do things when you're in the mood, everybody has their own moods. So you're in the mood to talk. You're in the mood to make up. You're in the mood to resolve the problem. Or you may be in the mood to apologize. So since you're in the mood, this is the right time. A person, generally speaking, makes their decision as to when is the right time based on how they feel, on their mood. And if you just follow that impulse, it's going to be problematical because the other person has his moods or her moods, whatever it is. Doesn't matter. So here too, it's a perfection that before you act, you put aside the emotion and you try to get a sense of the other person's emotions and a sense of when is the right time, not just from your perspective, but from the other perspective. But here too, getting back to our original issue, it has nothing to do with time. There's nothing in this particular time that's bad. It's rather the state of the other individual. When a person is in a certain state, he's simply not receptive. Not receptive to pacification, and to the contrary, it's going to make it worse. When a person is experiencing a certain shock with regard to loss of a loved one, so psychologically, they're not prepared for, because this is not a time for consolation. So consolation is a reality, but it only becomes possible within a certain psychological framework. So here too, there's got to be a rational basis. However, if we're talking about Lag BaOmer, and we're positing that this is a good time for prayer, what exactly does the person mean? In what sense? It's got to be something which makes sense. Now, in the case of the 10 days of repentance, we've shown that it makes sense because there's a reality of judgment and decree, and a person's fate for the coming year in terms of the physical situation is going to be determined. And depending on where you stand now, that's how God relates to us, Basher Husham, how he was at that particular time is very, very significant. So it's rational, even if you didn't do tshuva the whole year, and you're going to do it now. That's a rational decision. But to merely say that Lag BaOmer, or there are certain times when the prayers are just going to be accepted, and there's no rational factor that you could show, again, seems to smack of the superstitious, the mysterious, the mystical. All of these things run contrary to the basic idea of Schar V'Onesh, reward and punishment, which is that Hatzur Tam and Paolo, that the rock his works are perfect, that God relates to his creatures with justice and with truth and with compassion. But that to say that, arbitrarily speaking, this person happened to state their prayer at this particular time, and the other person, who is as good or maybe on a higher plane, didn't have the opportunity to pray at that time, prayed at a different time, and that would be the basis for the difference would just be an accident of time, would be an affront to the idea of God's justice. I want to return to a thought that I had begun before, and that is, you see that there's a very powerful attitude today among many Jews to try and relate to Judaism in a manner which would satisfy their emotion. There's a certain trend of taking mitzvos or taking things in Judaism and utilizing them in some type of a magical way. You see this phenomenon with Tehillim, as though the Tehillim per se has the power to cure someone. And that's why they have all these different groups. You can always tell when something makes sense, whether it's rational, it's a genuine desire to improve, or whether you're just using things as a panacea. So you have these different groups that are formed, and then they divide it up, and it's always related to some accomplishment. If we finish the Book of Tehillim in a certain time, then in all these people's names, the idea also of saying Mishabeirachs and praying and having all these lists also smacks of the same thing. Because it's not real prayer in the sense that you don't really know these people. You don't even know who you're praying for. You're just reading off a bunch of names. Reading off a bunch of names and Refuah Shleima, it becomes like an incantation kind of thing. It becomes almost magical. Even though there's no intent, there's no kavana, there's no thought. Because the truth is that when you pray for Refuah, so of course that's legitimate. The person should pray. But the prayer, the validity of the prayer is based upon the extent of the what we call the kavana, the extent to which the person is really involved in turning to God and then making the request. So that presupposes to a certain extent that you're really moved by the situation. Either it's for yourself, or it's for someone that's close to you, or it's someone that you know. But just to take names of people who you don't even know who they are, you're not involved with them in any way, shape, or form, and just read off lists, it's corrupting the basic idea of the tefillah, which is that it has to do with the level that you reach in terms of your involvement in the prayer. You raise yourself to a higher level through being involved in the prayer and the intention and the so-called the kavana. That is the true idea, but just again to use it and to make it into some type of a magical thing, that the more times we can recite this, just the recitation thing, if you just recite this enough and then have more people saying it, to give out this name on some kind of list so more people will say the name in a prayer, that'll bring something about, is attributing some type of a magical power to prayers, which is contrary to the true idea. With regard to Adar being a time of joy, Mishnechmas Adar Marvin Besimcha, that in the month of Adar you increase joy, and in Av, Mishnechmas Av Mamatin, that one decreases. And it's even brought down that if a person has a court case with a Gentile, he shouldn't schedule it for Av and all that. Bear in mind, though, that if he has no choice, of course he does it. It's not an absolute thing. the laws of nature don't operate. And if you have a law case, you're just going to lose. Or if you do it not in either, you're just going to win. It doesn't make much sense. What about the realities of the case? A good case is a good case. You have a good lawyer. A bad case is a bad case. So I don't believe that that's what it's saying. That if you go with a case, and I think this could probably be proved, it's very dangerous to take these types of things literally. It's always subject in that situation to somebody doing a study. All you need to do is do a study of all Jews that have court cases in these months and see whether you'll show any appreciable difference that a scientist would acknowledge is valid. Absent that, bear that in mind, that the Torah is supposed to be a source of wisdom, that those who hear its ideas will recognize and acknowledge its wisdom. So I don't think if anybody did a study, set up a study of Jews having court cases in Adar or in Av, I don't know that it would show any significant difference, if any difference at all. I don't think that's the point. The point is that we don't regard these events that occurred as being accidental, because these events come under the heading of the Hashkacha. That's why if you take a look at it, Av is really a time that, so to speak, is designated for Peronius, for punishments. It's amazing that both of the temples were destroyed on the same day. And so many other significant events that are interrelated occurred within a certain period of time, a certain time frame. That is, in my opinion, part of the idea to bring home to us that what happens to the Jewish nation is not an accident. It's a matter of schar v'onesh. That's a matter of divine providence. When we speak about the individual, that's a different thing, that the individual is not necessarily always subsumed under the providence. That depends upon his level of closeness to God at any given moment. However, the tzibur, the Jewish people, are always under the divine providence. So when calamities occur on a national level, that is something which is part of the divine providence. Interesting, along these lines, I was thinking about Rus, about the severe punishments that came to Elimelech, that he left the land because there was a famine. And he died. Seems like suffered very severe penalty. Then his sons married Moabite women. And according to most of the commentaries, they had not converted at that point. And then after 10 years, they died. What was the underlying sin? Chazal mentioned many factors, that he was a wealthy individual, he was a leader of the generation, and he could have sustained them. And Rashi mentions that he caved in to a certain type of pressure, because at that point in time, his entire fortune, so to speak, was in jeopardy. In ordinary times, a wealthy person can afford to give tzedakah, can give tzedakah, and can still retain a significant amount for himself. But there can be a situation where what the situation requires, in essence, would pretty much be everything you've got. Or, if not everything, then so much that it would make a significant change. According to Rashi, Tsar Ayin, he had, so to speak, a bad eye. He couldn't tolerate the idea that he'd have to give away so much to help others. So he left. But there's many factors over here. What was the nature of the sin? Okay. So he left, so it's not a good thing. He should have given tzedakah. But is that deserving of such harsh punishment? You do see an interesting thing over here. It says in the Yalkut Rus, Rav Parachia said that God was judging the world at that moment. The heavenly court was in place, and God was concealing Elimelech. As it is stated, and a man went. That is, it doesn't mention his name. It says, Vayelech Ish. Then the next pasuk, it says his name. To get to the pasukim, it says that in the first pasuk, in Rus, that it was in the days of the judging of the judges, and there was a famine in the land. And a man went from Beis Lechem, Yehuda, to dwell in the fields of Moab. He and his wife and his two sons. So it doesn't mention the name. Then the next pasuk says, and the name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife was Naomi, and the name of the two sons were Mahlon and Kilion, and so forth. That's a very, very strange formulation. It sort of begs for interpretation, because the whole thing could have been done in one sentence and just mentioned the names. So Rav Parachia is coming to explain Darshan, and his explanation is that God was judging the world at that moment. The heavenly court was in place, and now, referring to the first pasuk, in other words, this is the way he illustrates it. Obviously, it's a midrash. So he doesn't mention his name. The not mentioning the name means that God was concealing Elimelech, sort of covering him, protecting him. As it is stated, a man went. Then the attribute of strict justice arose and mentioned his name. As it is written, the man's name was Elimelech.
Amen.
The edict was then immediately pronounced upon him and his sons. So that's a very strange kind of a statement. It's depicting the heavenly court that would mean that God's intention was to judge him favorably. I'm reading from a commentary on Rus. It's just been translated into English. I wasn't aware of it before. It's called Ruth, the Scroll of Kindness. It's Megillas Rus with the commentary called Nachalas Yosef by Rabbi Yosef Lipowitz. I'm going to be quoting from what he states in interpretation of this statement of Chazal. This is on page 44. These two verses do not complement each other. They rather manifest the swinging of the scales between innocence and guilt. It was heaven's intention to judge them favorably. That is why the first verse concealed their names and tried to save them. The attribute of strict justice, however, turned the scales. The prophet then wrote for eternal memory, quote, the man's name was Elimelech, etc. The idea itself needs to be interpreted. Can't be taken literally, that God wanted to protect them. But strict justice mentioned their names. That was responsible for destroying them. The edict was then for destruction. What's the point of that? If God wanted to protect them, so then that's justice. Or perhaps God didn't want to utilize strict justice. Sometimes God relates to us in the framework of what we would call compassion. It would seem that strict justice has an existence of its own and it thwarted the will of God to protect them. I think the general idea over here is that the very same action would be treated differently depending upon who is doing it. And I think there's two reasons for that. That is to say, the idea of someone seeking to escape from a situation of famine, even though it's Eretz Yisrael, would be wrong perhaps, but would not be necessarily that terrible or that tragic. But over here, so that's the base, that's the first pasuk reflects that idea, that a man went. If a man went and the person doesn't have anything specific, is not distinguished, that's one type of thing. And that could be accepted. Doesn't mean necessarily that the person is automatically forgiven, but it would not constitute such a tragedy. However, by then mentioning the name of the person, which of course indicates that this was a very distinguished person. And then we have the tradition, Chazal mentioned that he was a Parnes Hador, there's different opinions whether he was even a judge. That is a whole different story. There, I would say, for two reasons. That it's not the same sin. If it's done by a great individual, the great individual, of course, is going to be judged differently. You have to understand, if we look at a sin as being, you know, going through a red light, then you get a ticket and so forth, so then it's not really going to make any difference who it is that's doing it. That's not our view of sin. But every sin reflects a certain type of a corruption. And there's different levels that a person is on. And there are things that are acceptable. We recognize that a person is subjected to stress. And under the stress of the situation, so they did a certain thing. So because of that, given their level, it doesn't reflect such a corruption. Okay, how much can you demand from a person? We always utilize that, especially with children or younger people. If you understood where he was at that time, you'll always look back at your past and recognize you did things that horrify you now. In light of your current level, that horrifies you. But then, it didn't seem bad. And you want people to understand that. Given where you were then, in terms of how much you understood, in terms of how much commitment, or your ability to control your emotions, so you did it. However, now, when you've matured, and now that your understanding is so much greater, and your knowledge, for you to do the same thing, that would indicate a very serious breakdown. That would be a tremendous corruption. It's not the same. Thus, the same can be applied to different people. It's much worse, for example, if an ordinary Jew who's on a certain level, so he gets into a temptation, or he's led astray by a certain type of seduction, or some kind of a shady business deal. He's going to be treated on one level, given where he's at. But if it's someone who's a great scholar and a refined person, someone who ought to know better, so that's much more serious. You have to look at it differently. It can't be forgiven. The whole idea of forgiving really has to do with that. That's the element of the compassion. That is to say that the person really, in that situation, couldn't have been expected to do better, or if they could have been expected to do better, but you can understand. There's less restraint, and then there's the potential. If you let the person go, then they'll develop. But once the person is developed and should know better, and then they sinned, that is indicative of a more significant kind of a corruption. On the other hand, also bear in mind that this is very, very important. The whole substance of the sin is different. In this situation, Chazal pointed out that when he left, it wasn't just him personally. It had a tremendous impact upon the community. You can imagine, not everybody has the same impact on the community. So you have to take into consideration not just yourself, but the tzibur. I think that's a very significant theme in the whole book. It was really abandoning the tzibur. What he was doing was abandoning the tzibur, the community. Not just abandoning it, but his abandonment had a very negative, destructive effect upon it. When a situation is bad, there's a sense of despair. So people turn to their leaders. And the leaders, the job of the leaders is to carry them through moments of stress. That's really all people have. That's when great leaders emerge. At the beginning of World War II, for example, when England was suffering defeats, but there was Churchill was able to convey a certain sense of courage and steadfastness. That's very, very significant. So that he prevented a panic. He prevented the nation from despair. Other countries fell apart. France was overturned in a matter of days. So the role of a leader in certain situations is to maintain the spirit of the people. If you can maintain the spirit of the people, then you can rally They can get by through very dire circumstances. Now, a person who's in such a position, when he turns his back on the people, it has a destructive effect. Because now they're being abandoned by their own leaders. So that's really a very serious corruption. The abandonment of the tzibur and the whole negation of Klal Yisrael. It carries many, many factors with it. In point of fact, the Rambam, which we've studied, says that this very point, that when bad things occur, a person shouldn't treat it as just an ordinary event. This is just a result of nature. Bad things occur to the Jewish people. Because if you're doing that, you're denying God. You're denying the special nature of the Jews and the relationship with God. And that's why it says, if you do that, then it's going to get worse. I'll make it worse. So, in seeking to escape from the situation, there's a number of factors over here. It's a base thing. It's Poresh Midarchei Tzibur. He separated himself from the Tzibur and was not cognizant of the effect that it would have. That is, he was looking at it purely from the vantage point of his own personal needs, not taking into consideration the impact it would have on the whole Tzibur. That's something that a person has to take into consideration. And then it's true, the greater the person is, the more of an influence he is on the Tzibur, so the greater his responsibilities. Because his leaving the Tzibur has a greater negative impact. Whereas a lesser individual, the impact is going to be less. That's a reality.
You know what that reminds me of?
It's being pointed out that this is similar to Moshe's rebuke of Reuven and Gad when they came to him with the proposal that they be allowed to take their share, their inheritance, on the eastern side of the Yarden, which wasn't part of the original land that God had promised. But because they had a tremendous amount of livestock, and when they conquered those lands, they saw that it was very good for grazing. And then what happens is very strange. Moshe launches into a stinging rebuke, reminding them of the sin of the spies and how their behavior had a negative effect on the Jews. They had instilled a certain type of panic. Well, that's identical to what we're saying over here. Of course, that was due to the fact that the spies, the Meraglim, were leaders of every, they were leaders of the Jewish people, leaders of the tribes. They were very distinguished people, and people looked up to them. And they were placed in a position. It wasn't just the fact that they were great people. By virtue of the fact that they were selected for the mission, so their report would have a tremendous impact. And there, it wasn't that they neglected to consider the impact. To the contrary, they were fully aware of that. And their intention, which was to thwart the entry into the land at that point in time, because they were subjected to fear, nevertheless, the impact was that they instilled a sense of panic. And this led to a great, great calamity. So Moshe Rabbeinu, at first, launches into a very severe attack against them. However, in light of what takes place afterwards, that is that they give tremendous reassurances that that's not their intention, that they will join together with the Jews in crossing over the Yarden. The fear was that perhaps they're taking their inheritance on the other side because they're afraid to fight. And this would be demoralizing. But as I explained, Moshe Rabbeinu proceeded to criticize them. Even though, had he taken a different approach, he didn't have to criticize them at that point. He could have told them what the conditions were. He could have told them what the problem was. And then if they still persisted, then he could have criticized them. But if it turns out that they're willing to abide by the conditions, so, fine, what's the problem? The question over there is that it doesn't make sense to deal with people that way. When somebody makes a proposal to you that they want to, they're asking for a certain change in the plan, then you think of a possible negative consequence. And you say, okay, you want to do that, but have you thought about the effect it's going to have on something else? Now, you at least owe them the benefit of the doubt. Let's see what they have to say. If they say, well, I don't care about that, I just want my own things, and then you have a right to criticize. But let's say the person just didn't think of that. And now that you pointed it out to me, I agree. And they offered to address it in a manner which is completely satisfactory. It was completely satisfactory because Moshe then proceeded to give them permission. So in light of that, why did he criticize them before they even had a chance to respond to his concern? Well, the answer that I gave was that in ordinary situations, a person is not to be blamed necessarily for not having thought of all the consequences of his plans. That's negotiation. I'm coming to talk to you. This is my plan. And you, upon hearing it, may think of consequences. But this is different. Because this was a negation. This was a denial. You had witnessed this yourself. You had gone through this history, and you realized the significance of this problem. So to be completely concerned with your own immediate need, and not even to think. Here there was a defect in the fact that you yourself didn't anticipate this problem and come prepared with an answer. But anyways, this is a very good support for what we're saying. That a person has an obligation to the tzibur in everything that they do. That is, you're being judged not purely in terms of your personal level. Of course, that's first and foremost, that's the most important thing. But you have to take into consideration the effect that your actions are going to have on others in your circle. I mean, there's different circles. Everybody has a different circle. Some people, the circle is small. Just perhaps their family or their some friends. So then it gets bigger. Perhaps you're a teacher, you have some students. Then you may be a leader of a community. Or you may be a leader of Klal Yisrael. It doesn't really matter. But you also have to take into consideration the effect that it's going to have on others. Certainly we say this with regard, another example would be that when the Rambam explains Chilul Hashem. So there are certain things that are objectively speaking a desecration of God's name. But then he says there are certain things that in and of themselves are not corrupt, are not sinful. That is to say, if a person buys on credit and doesn't pay immediately, but pays up, then pays his bills, that's not a crime, it's not a sin. Or if a person has a stain on his garment, that's not a sin. But the Rambam says all these things, if it's a Talmud Chacham, if it's a Torah scholar, that could be a Chilul Hashem. That is to say that he has money and he doesn't pay his bills, even though he has time and he took it on credit. Because he's expected to live according to a higher standard of concern, and he wants to pay his bills quickly, and he doesn't want the other person to have to wait for his money. So things that you see, different, yeah, it's different standards. That the Talmud Chacham has to live by a different standard. Because once he reaches a certain level and he reflects certain ideals, he can't just be judged by simply the ordinary laws. He has to be judged by adherence to a certain standard of perfection, that a perfected person would act in a certain way. But that's not expected of the ordinary Jew, that everything he does is going to be on the standard of perfection. So he's judged differently. He doesn't break any laws. He didn't violate anything. Okay, so he's not on he's not on the level of perfection. And in a certain situation where, let's say there's an accident in a bus or a train, things of that sort, and then assistance comes. So then the average person, as soon as, you know, when let's say the supplies, the reliefs, the medicines or food you've been starving is given out, so then people take it and use it. But a more perfected person is the kind, the leader, for example. The leader is generally the one who makes sure that everybody gets theirs, then he eats. That's expected of a leader. So all things being equal, that's an example of a different standard that there are different people are on different levels. There's leaders and there's followers, and the followers are expected to adhere to one level of conduct. A leader, and you find this in everything, in the army and in politics and government, the leaders are expected to, anyways, to adhere to a higher standard. Getting back to the point of Adar and Av, I think that it's not that there's anything inherent in the time itself, but it's in how we relate to it. That a person should relate to the joy of the phenomenon of Adar in recognition of the fact that it's Hashkacha, that the Jewish people lives under the framework of divine providence, and that sometimes the providence works things out in a way that there's great joy, the element of salvation. That's one aspect of the expression of the divine providence towards the Jews. That's part of the Torah, the blessings and the curses. But we also have to see how it's reflected in history. That's a support to the basic emunah, that it is reflected in history. And when it's reflected in history, it's done in a manner which makes it clear that these things are not chance phenomena. So we gear our actions in accordance with that. And the same is true. Av is also a reflection of the phenomena of divine providence as it relates to the Jewish people, but here is from the standpoint of peronius, of suffering. Those are the two aspects of the divine providence relating to God's nation. And if it's merit, if we act properly, when the Jews did tshuva and returned to God, so there was salvation. When the Jews abandoned the path, they didn't listen to the prophets, and they became corrupt, so then there was destruction. In either case, it's not an accident. So part of the observance is the recognition that it's divine providence, it's not an accident. And we have to base our activities on that, to reflect that concept. That we recognize how vital the element of divine providence is in our endeavors, such that this is, if divine providence is against us, so we're not going to be successful. And one way of reflecting on that idea is not to schedule a court case at that particular time, because that could be something which we would require divine providence. And contrarily, in the month of Adar, where the element of divine providence is expressing itself in a positive way. But I don't think it's just an automatic thing. There's the same distortion that people will say this is a lucky month, that's an unlucky month. That would be a complete distortion. And again, resorting to superstition and magic. That's my understanding of how we should relate to these types of things.